Blog Talk Radio.
My calculations are correct. When this baby hits 88 miles per hour, you're gonna see some serious sh.
I guess there's no words in that trailer either. You know, believe it or not, I listened to these before I put them up, and I guess I just don't notice when the picture's there. I thought there was more to that, but as you can hear, that's the trailer for Skyfall, the new James Bond movie, one of the movies we're talking about this week, as well as Lincoln, Steven Spielberg's latest adventure into cinematic greatness, not to be followed by War Horse, I guess, in the minds of a lot of people. Also,
What? I'm totally lost. What are you talking about?
Well, Lincoln, you know, Steven Spielberg had a part in it, and his last big movie was War Horse, and right. Most people wouldn't put that in his great category, so I'm saying let's not think of that as following this up. Let's just think of it as a different movie. And also A Late Quartet, which I keep calling the Late Quartet, which we actually will be talking to Imogen, or I keep wanting to say Imogen. I'm guessing she gets that a lot.
Imogen Poots.
Travis got a chance to talk to her. We'll be playing that full interview for you today. What's your thoughts on A Late Quartet? I'm hearing, am I hearing a lot about it being awards contender, or is it just that it seems that way?
I don't know. I don't know if it'll get Oscar contention, but I can certainly see it maybe taking a best cast category, like at the Golden Globes or something. I think they still have that best ensemble category there. I can see it definitely taking that. It stars Philip Seymour Hoffman and Christopher Walken, Catherine Keener, Mark E. Veneer, and Imogen Poots, which is, I mean, that's a fivesome that it's pretty tough to beat.
Yeah.
And they're all really outstanding in this film. It basically follows a string quartet who've been together for 25 years, and they're basically like their own little family. But when one of them comes down with a disease and has to retire, all sorts of personal ambitions and old grudges and all sorts of things just kind of bubble up to the surface and threaten to break the group apart. Imogen Poots plays the daughter of Keener and Philip Seymour Hoffman's characters. She's a talented violinist of her own right. She causes some additional headaches in the film. I don't want to spoil anything for those who may want to go check it out. But she causes some additional headaches and actually makes things a lot worse than they already were. But it's a phenomenal film. It does get a little overdramatic and soap opera-y. There's a lot of little threads that are going through it, a lot of storylines, a lot of angles. But the acting is so superb that you can kind of look over it when it gets a little melodramatic. Overall, I gave it a 3.5 out of 5. So, I mean, if people want to check it out, I say go ahead. It's got some great music, too. And I did talk to her a little bit about the process of learning these instruments for the film. So it was a fun interview.
Now, you saw this last week at Virginia Film Festival, which, we take 1 week off, and it seems like it's been forever since we've been on air. We had many shows in between, but I mean, the Sunday night show was given 1 week, and it feels like it's been forever. But one thing you said to me that I found really interesting about the movie was we had just seen
stand-up guys with Christopher Walken and Al Pacino. And you had mentioned that Christopher Walken is doing something very counter to what he's known for these days, and that he's not Christopher Walken in this movie, L.A. Quartet.
Right. Now, this is probably, out of everything he's been doing some great stuff lately. Seven Psychopaths and L.A. Quartet and stand-up guys. I think he's fantastic in all three.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, he's kind of dialing it back a little bit. Kind of dialing back the Walken, I would say. he's a little less crazy, a little more reserved, restrained. And I like it. I like having a chance to see him show different aspects of his character. We don't get to see it enough. He's always kind of the guy who's a little bit offbeat compared to everybody else. And I like seeing him play something more straight up. I mean, even in stand-up guys, he's the more relaxed of the three compared to Al Pacino and Alan Arkin.
Mm-hmm.
Alan Arkin's sort of in between. But Walken, especially compared to Pacino, is basically the straight man. And it's interesting to see him in that role. And I think he's kind of found a new niche if he wants to proceed this way.
Right. Yeah, you know, I mean, I think it's strange for a lot of people to see him in movies pre 1995, let's even say, you know, which pretty much made The Walken we know today with that Saturday Night Live skit. But I mean, you know, back to Deer Hunter, which made him most famous, and then even mm-hmm. as a Bond villain, he was way more reserved than he is nowadays. So I'm really interested to see it just for that reason, to see him again in that more actor role and less of a caricature role.
Right. Yep.
So, do you want to jump right into the interview since we just talked about it, or?
Why don't we go ahead and do that? Let's listen to the talk with Imogen Poots. It's only about 10 minutes long, so listen to that, and then we'll jump into our reviews of Skyfall and Steven Spielberg's Lincoln.
Yeah, and if anybody hasn't seen the movie, and you're going to hear her voice, and it's going to really give you an idea of what she looks like. She's beautiful, in case you guys want to imagine that while you're listening to this. So here's Travis talking to Imogen Poots.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm really good, Travis. Thank you.
No, thank you for calling in. I appreciate it. I had a chance to see L.A. Quartet over the weekend at we had our Virginia Film Festival here over the weekend, and it was one of the films playing.
Oh, that's great. How great.
Yeah. Yes, and it got a great response, I must say.
I love West Virginia. So that's a good thing.
Oh, awesome. So I have to ask, how did you get involved with the film to begin with?
Originally, I just read the script and then went to New York to read with Yaron, the director.
Mm-hmm.
But it was mainly a discursive process more than anything, you know, just he's so informed of classical music and Beethoven, and it was really getting a hold on that and understanding the challenge ahead as to educating myself as much as possible on classical music, chamber music, and then fundamentally being able to play the violin. So it was kind of all those things together, and Catherine Keener was already involved with the project, and I believe had been for a while, so that was a big, big draw. And yeah, that was pretty much it.
How much had you even picked up a violin before you signed on to the movie? Had you played any musical instruments before that?
No, I hadn't ever played a violin. I played the cello when I was much younger, about 6, 7.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it wasn't really something that I could use because the violin is almost like the cello in reverse, in a sense.
Mm.
And obviously everything on the violin is much closer together.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really starting from square one, but I had an extraordinary tutor. She was about 24, from Juilliard, and we had one-on-one sessions, and her patience was extraordinary, because that's what blew my mind, is some imbecile of an actor strolls on in, being like, I got to play the violin in under 2 months, and they have to sort of bear with you. But it's such a rewarding process, too, when you're able to essentially master or think you've mastered something, vibrato or those things.
Did you kind of take to it? Like, do you still play now that the filming is over?
I said to myself at the time I would. I was like, this is great. I'm going to leave this film. I'm going to join a folk band, and it's going to be terrific. But that didn't really happen as of yet. But I think it was such an intense process with Divine that by the time the film was over, I sort of replaced that with a glass of wine or something.
Now, each of these characters in this movie, one of the things I really love about it is that they're all really, they kind of identify with their individual instruments in a way. Like, they're all really, they almost see, like, their instrument as a part of their family, in a sense, you know what I mean?
Sure.
Did playing the instrument kind of get you closer in tune with your character?
Absolutely, and that was one of the most important things, I think, about learning the instrument, was that I wanted to forget about it, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
I really wanted it to be, like, an innate quality within Alexandra, and the physicality of holding the instrument, all these things, almost like it's an extra limb, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, the director said to me, I want you to take the violin with you everywhere on your back, you know, this big hard case, and I did that, and he was right in a way, because it was just always on my person. It's like you go somewhere, and especially because these instruments are so precious,
right.
It's almost like having some sort of child with you. You just don't ever leave it alone. But no, that was key.
Mm-hmm. Well, the film is essentially about you know, a group of musicians who are kind of have a falling out when things start to go a different direction for them. And your character is sort of she kind of makes things a little bit worse at one point in a way. So can you kind of talk to me about the dynamic of all the characters involved in the film and how yours relates to them?
Sure. Well, I think also what was interesting is in the sense all the characters are trying to create something harmonious and ideal.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the irony is their own lives are sort of, their dynamics are damaged and they're flawed people and they make mistakes and they're striving to create this as I said before, this harmony sort of without pause. But I think in a way, you know, you've got Christopher Walken's character, who's very much a father figure to Keena's, and then Phil and Catherine's dynamic within the film was obviously what was going to inform Alexandra in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
So I always thought of Alexandra as wanting to be sophisticated in a sense, but all of that being a bit of a facade, because when it came down to it, she didn't really have the expertise or the life experience to cope with what she'd brought upon herself.
Right.
And also, she's just quite insatiable, I think, at the age she is. She's certainly looking for fulfillment, and then every time she gets close to actually having what she wants, she sort of destructs it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's sort of explained in the scene between Alexandra and Juliet, where she just says, you know, you weren't there for me. And so she's finding stability in odd places. And none of them are holding strong. But also she speaks out of term, and she respects her mother and father immensely. That's why she's continuing down the same road that they have done. But at the same time kind of scolds herself for doing that, because I think in some way, I'm sure if you follow in your parents' footsteps, you must feel some sort of confusion as to, are you doing this for your own identity, or are you doing it to please somebody else.
Right. That's a very good point. You've worked with some great casts in the past, but this one is like a true actor showcase. I mean,
it's Philip Seymour
Hoffman, Walken, Keener. What was it like working, even Mark Evanier? I know a lot of people here don't know him as well, but he's a fantastic actor.
Absolutely.
What was it like working with all of them together?
It was an extremely special experience in my life. It really was, and I was quite happy just to shut the hell up and listen to everybody else and, you know, observe Phil and Catherine and Christopher and Mark too, you know, just the mm-hmm. way that they went about dissecting the characters or not at all, and the sense of play. It was a very, very organic feel to the rehearsals and very collaborative, and the thing about them is, I'm sure the idea could be quite intimidating, but they're so gentle.
Mm-hmm.
And I just had such immense respect for, you know, like Phil and Catherine, that and all of them, that you just put all your trust in them, and there's a sense that you can go as far as you want to. But I really look to this film as one of the greatest experiences I've ever had as an actor, just to be exposed to them in when the film was in quite skeletal form, you know, and the foundation was being laid down, and seeing how they went about that. And also the sense of fun, that's it, that's fundamental. They laugh a lot.
Did you guys, I was going to ask, did you guys, like after you guys, you know, each of you learned your instruments, did you guys have some really funny moments where you're trying to get your harmony down? Because I imagine that's a hard thing to try to replicate.
Well, Catherine and Phil and Chris and Mark, they had to really practice a lot together, because obviously they have the big finale scenes and all the rehearsals where they collaborate. But I'm sure I had a slightly easier road, in that I only had to learn specific segments of the Opus 131,
right,
and those phrases repeated. And then also, because I was doing it alone, I could kind of go to my own timing and do it that way. So I definitely had like an easier time of it. But yeah, it's kind of amazing what they did. I got goosebumps when I watched their pieces back.
Talk to me about working with Yaron Zilberman. This is his first major feature film. How was he to work with?
Yaron was really wonderful to work with. You know, he knew what he was talking about. You know, he's so informed and educated in classical music and Beethoven. And I really felt so excited to be working with him, because he had this quality which he just encouraged and bring something out of you, but at the same time trust you, and was very, very readily there to listen and help you through something. Because I think the worst thing is if you can't trust your director, then you're just completely in the dark.
Right.
So it's always a joy to work on something where that person's with you every step of the way. And I love some of his advice, as I said before, about carrying the violin around everywhere with me. It was such a cool idea and something that I took on board and really enjoyed.
This film is obviously a little bit different than some of the other movies you've done, like let's just say the Fright Night remake or something like that. How do you approach a movie like this in relation to some of the other movies you've done? Is it differently, or do you do everything kind of the same?
I think you always, there's some sort of common ground with every approach you do, but obviously I feel more than ever my approaches and processes certainly changed since I first started out in a big way, and I think I definitely sort of cherish that development, because that's where you know that you've come from somewhere and you're hopefully going somewhere, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely.
So Fright Night, we did the summer before A Late Quartet, and that was just a different beast altogether, just in terms of the time period and the character, and it was a studio film, so there was more space, if that makes sense. Whereas A Late Quartet had this brilliant sort of precision and tight schedule, which was necessary, I think, to get things done.
Right.
They were different, certainly.
Right. Things have obviously been taking off for you lately. You seem to be attached to a lot of things all of a sudden, like in the last couple of weeks alone.
I know.
How are you dealing with all the added attention?
Oh, I don't really feel any different. I mean, it's just the one thing that's changed is being able to work or have an opportunity to work on things that you really adore. And, you know, A Late Quartet was one of them. And then this Buckley movie we did last year was another. And this year there have been some projects that I've just absolutely adored working on. So it just, it's funny in a way, because it's such a fast-moving train sometimes that you sort of just keep going and just remember to really take time, because all of this is very fleeting and transient too. And just sort of try and enjoy every moment and learn from it and never forget why you started doing it in the first place and all these things. But it's very exciting, and I'm very lucky to be in the position that I am.
Well, Imogen, I'm pretty sure our time is just about up, but I want to really thank you for calling in. It was great having a chance to talk to you.
Likewise.
And I hope, hopefully, when some of these other projects start moving, we'll talk to you again.
You betcha.
Hey, where are the white women at?
Was that you?
I
that
can't believe
me.
You did that. I
just
can't
so everyone knows,
that
wasn't me this time.
I can't believe you hit that at that moment. It's so tasteless.
I was trying to hit back to show.
No, that was a lot of fun. I'm a big fan of hers, and you heard at the end there, I was asking her about some of the projects that she's got coming up. She recently signed on to star in the Need for Speed movie that's coming out based on the video game. She's also going to be in Are We Officially Dating with Zac Efron and Deborah Ann Woll from True Blood and Michael B. Jordan from Chronicle. So she's got a lot coming up. And she's part of that short list of actresses who are up for Captain America, the Winter Soldier.
Mm.
So she's got a lot of stuff that is happening and could be happening. So, you know, if you don't know who Imogen Poots is now from the Fright Night remake or some of the other things she's done, she'll be pretty hard to miss over the next few months.
Yeah, you'll know her name this time next year. You might even be pronouncing it correctly this time next year. I know I'll have a hard time with that, but eventually I'll get to it. All right, so we got two major movies coming up. When is just drop for people if we know when is the Late Quartet hit theaters?
Late Quartet is in theaters now, so you can see it now. I'm not sure how big its rollout was, but I know it's here in DC and it should be in most major cities.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, it looks like it's in about 62 theaters now, so that should be that comprises pretty much LA, New York, DC, Miami. So look mm-hmm. for a bigger rollout coming here soon. So we got two big movies, Lincoln and Skyfall. Lincoln, I was thwarted by the mistaken release date that I thought it had. So we'll have to have a Q&A with you about that. You want to talk about Lincoln first or Skyfall?
No, we got to talk Skyfall first. I'm sure people are waiting to hear our opinion on that. So let's talk about Skyfall first of all. And we kicked off the show with a Skyfall clip, so we have to talk Skyfall.
We can kick off the review with one as well.
I appreciate the occasional twist, Mr.
Bond. James Bond.
Oh, that was... both my clips were screwed up, apparently, because that was too low. He said Bond, James Bond, in case anyone didn't know. So Skyfall picks up... it doesn't really say where it picks up in the continuum. You end up finding out, but as far as in relation to Quantum Solace, doesn't really say. Starts out with Bond...
Thank God.
Yeah. Bond... I have my theory on Quantum Solace I'll get to eventually, but... Skyfall starts out with Bond and another agent chasing down somebody that has basically a hard drive full of the covers of every agent that's embedded with a terrorist organization throughout the planet.
The very default MacGuffin for movies like this.
Yeah, I'm
sick of that. I'm sick of that plot device now.
Yeah.
I'm tired of it.
Knock list is all I think of. Is the very, very
yeah.
first impossible. But I guess if you just want to have a caravan for the action, I guess that's a believable enough way to go. Towards the end, unlike most Bond movies, Bond doesn't end out this opening scene very well. He actually gets shot and falls, believably, to his death. We find out later that he did not die. He's been just living in exile, and somebody is targeting MI6, and in particular M, with this list that they're threatening to release over, of all things, YouTube, which is now part of the Bond universe, every 2 weeks until... something happened. They actually really don't even give an ultimatum. It's basically saying to M, look out for yourself. There's something in M's past, played by Judi Dench, that is coming back to haunt her and in turn haunt all the agents of MI6 and put everybody in deep jeopardy. Enter Bond against a lot of people that don't think he has it anymore. Yet another movie. You talked about that MacGuffin being over too much. I'm done with the action heroes thinking or making I'm too old for this jokes or other people making they're too old for this jokes. But
Bond, it's not something we've seen in Bond before.
I know. I don't know. I don't want to say I'm a Bond purist because that's not true. It's just I like my Bond a certain way. And you know, it doesn't affect Daniel Craig's James Bond at all. But there are a lot of people – it actually makes him kind of cooler because you see what he's dealing with. But, you know, there's a lot of jokes about his age. He's getting too old for it. Time to hang it up. And in the age of the internet and everybody doing everything virtually, everybody's wondering what the need is for an agent to physically be out in the field and basically kill people the way Bond – is. So he's basically a dinosaur of another era. So all this goes through, we find out it's Silva,
Rodrigo Silva, played by Javier Bardem, is the Bond villain this time, who has a grudge against M for a reason that I'll let you go see the movie to find out. But through there, they have to take care of the bad guy, save the day, just as usual. This movie, Skyfall, really delves a lot farther into who Bond is. I mean, Bond is always the shallowest of characters of any action, and that's saying a lot of action movies. You know, he's historically been the shallowest action hero there is, where you don't really learn much about him. In the entirety of the Bond films previous, I think it was on Her Majesty's Secret Service, I believe, is the only one that we really get a look at his personal life, which is when he gets married and his wife is murdered right after that, driving the plot. But you never hear anything about it. He's very shallow, and they kind of get into who he is, why he is the way he is, and everything about Bond in this one. And you know what? There's a twist at the end. I don't know if you can call it a twist, but I didn't see it coming, so I'm going to call it that. That really kind of was awesome for me. And I think a lot of Bond fans will find it awesome. It really makes this Daniel Craig voyage as Bond at the starting point, and it makes everything before it make a lot more sense about where you were and why things didn't make sense.
You know, I honestly believe this, and I said this at on it might have been Tim's show or it might have been on someone else's show, but I said that I think this is the best Bond film in years. I'm going to amend that and say it's the best Bond film yet.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen them all, and I think I have more enjoyment out of this one than I have out of a Bond in a long time. I liked Casino Royale. I didn't love it like some people did,
mm-hmm.
and like most, I did not like Quantum of Solace. And I pretty much said that. I think that if this movie had been a flop creatively, then they might have had to start over from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just because that's how bad Quantum of Solace was that if they had done two in a row that stunk on that same level, then they were in serious trouble. But fortunately, Skyfall is not bad. In fact, it's amazing. And part of the reason is because it gives us an inside look at Bond the way we haven't seen in a very long time. We haven't seen him be struck in such a personal way as he is in this movie. And you referenced on Your Majesty's Secret Service. Well, my thing with Bond has always been that I don't really identify him through the women in his life.
Mm-hmm.
Like if one of them dies, you know, big deal. They kind of did that with Quantum of Solace when Ava Green's character died or whatever it was, you know, mm-hmm. and they tried to make him all angry and he's always out for revenge. I didn't buy it. You know, I mean, I just didn't buy it. But the one serious relationship he's had for the last 50 years has been with M,
mm-hmm.
you know, and, you know, they're not romantically involved, but she's been the one steady figure in his life that whole time. And attacking her was the surest way to get to him in a way that made sense and that felt relevant to me.
Right.
So that's why I love this movie so much. And that's one of the things I really dug about it. But now, beyond that, Sam Mendes, who I don't think I ever would have predicted would be a great James Bond director, he really does some fantastic things here visually. The Shanghai scene alone, this neon-lit night sky is just amazing. It's breathtaking. And they have this really slick, fast-paced hand-to-hand battle that goes on in the night sky there, and it just looks great. Visually, this is about as good of a Bond film as there's been in a very long time.
Yeah, that scene you're talking about, the Shanghai scene, the whole Hong Kong sequence, to me, was just, you know, perfect Bond and better, mm-hmm. you know, from the casino to everywhere. But that scene in particular, I remember seeing that in the first trailers for it, and I just assumed that was a spiced up scene, you know, with visual effects to look cool for the trailer.
Right.
But that's legit, like signs in Hong Kong, and they actually is in the scene, and it doesn't look out of place because it is real. And that scene in particular where the whole battle, the whole fight is in almost shadow form. I mean, you're seeing them, but they're in a darkly room where you just have silhouettes, basically. And that 30 seconds of back-to-back where he's kicking the gun out of his hand and back and forth, that 30 seconds was some of the coolest fight scene I've ever seen in my entirety. You know, it's not that there were the coolest moves. It wasn't, you know, that was super innovative. It was just that it was silhouetted, and they worked in a way. It was almost like watching one of the Bond opening credit sequences in a fight form. Now,
right.
Speaking of the open credit sequences, this, with hands down, this is the best opening credit sequence of any Bond movie I've ever seen.
There's some other ones I like better, but this one is pretty good. I mean, Adele's soundtrack is amazing, and I didn't really like the last one's opening credit sequence. It just seemed a little weird, but I love this one. How it sets up some of the things we're going to see in the future of the film. It just looks really good. So, I mean, I really dug it myself.
Right. Now, some of the other stuff, I mean, we could literally spend probably 3 hours dissecting this movie, but some of the main stuff to me that I really liked was that, you know, when I mentioned Honor Majesty's Secret Service, you know, yeah, that was with a woman his life, and unfortunately, Bond to this point has only been identified personally by the woman his life, even if it's that shallow. And I think the fact that we got some of, you know, his background all the way back to his childhood, but not in a way that's like, oh, we're breaking the Bond code by telling you this. It was organic to the story, and I thought it really enhanced a lot of stuff. It really made it a lot better. I definitely liked his involvement with Q. I was kind of worried about it at first. Because when they first come in, it's kind of like, you know, new hip kid, old war horse, and I thought it was going to be like that. But their cooperation, the way they work together, I thought was one of the coolest things I'd seen.
The same dynamic is there. The same dynamic you've seen between Bond and all of his quartermasters. It's always sort of contentious and jokey, and, you know, they kind of, you know, prod each other along. That's kind of it's the same dynamic there. And then one of the things I liked about Ben Whishaw's Q is that he might be the young kid, but he's not all about new slick gadgets. He's kind of old school in a way,
right?
You know, he's a fan of the old ways. You know, they even make a joke about it. What were you expecting, an exploding pen?
Yeah.
You know, they make jokes about it, and I think that's smart. The film is very nostalgic, as it should be for if you're going to be celebrating the 50th anniversary of Bond this year. It should be a little nostalgic, but it doesn't go overboard. There's one really cool scene that I don't want to get into involving an old vehicle of Bond's.
No.
But yeah, I mean, it's nostalgic, not going overboard. And I think, but while it's doing that, probably the prevailing theme of the entire film is that sometimes the old ways are the best.
Yeah.
I mean, that seems to be like the main thrust of the film. So it's a nice little mix there, and I think they walk it pretty well.
Yeah. Let's talk about Javier Bardem's Rodrigo Silva. This is a guy that, you know, everybody saw. I had faith in it because Javier Bardem plus bad haircut equals great role. And this one, he is – now, I don't know if anybody out there listening or if you, Travis, are going to remember my reference here, but – looking at him, all I could think about was Brendan Fraser's basketball player in Bedazzled.
Yeah, I remember.
that's just what I was thinking of the whole time. But, I mean, he is so he walks such a fine line between over the edge, over the top and sadistically sinister in, like, the craziest of ways. Right up until his entrance scene, which kind of, I think, threw a lot of people for a loop and then really didn't, like, I don't know how to put it without giving anything away, but you know, he does a lot of weird things that you weren't expecting him to do, but the way he just follows everything with his kind of laissez-faire way of being, and then he's so good at lowering his voice or raising his voice to a certain point where it's sounds like the simplest thing, but it makes it that much more disturbing.
You know, I like them. I like the Silva. Only because he and Bond are sort of like flip sides of the same coin. In a lot of ways, they're both, you know, guys who've been left behind or recently screwed by MI6 at some point. They're kind of like the guys who've been left behind a little bit. And I like the fact that Silva recognizes that in Bond and tries to play up that aspect of it. I mean, it's not often that we see a Bond villain who tries to actually turn Bond, and, you know, and actually try to play off a very real concern that Bond should have. I mean, he's getting older, and his department could be leaving him in the dust. I mean, it makes sense for Silva to try and kind of change Bond's attitude a little bit. But in terms of the performance itself, you know, I mean, I guess I'm always going to compare any Javier Bardem villain role to Anton Chigurh, You know, I'm always going to do it, even if they're like polar opposites. And Silva and Anton Chigurh couldn't be more different. Silva is more flamboyant than anything else. He's petty. He's jealous. You know, he's all these things. He's a show off. Whereas Chigurh is very cold, and this is what's going to happen, so it just happens. Let's just do it.
Well, that's why your two sides of the same coin for him and Bond was so. So accurate is because really Bond is a lot more like Chagrin other than the not talking part, you know, the way he conducts himself. And they, you know, they are more alike than Bardem or Silva. And Chagrin is not the way you say it, I don't know. But you know what I mean? Guy with the bowl cut. But it's just like there wasn't as much his plan kind of – that's the only thing that bothered me about the movie was – he had this big, huge plan that really kind of went to the wayside. Like if you get rid of him, you still have a problem. These videos are getting released and these covers are being blown. And they even show the real consequences when some agents are executed live on, like, Al Jazeera or something like that. I can go with the fact that that he kind of was just using that to get to his end point, which we found. I would have liked at least an offhand sentence to you know, rectify the big problem that the movie was following in the first place.
I don't know. I guess I didn't really think about that aspect of it. I just kind of figured when his main goal was just to hurt him. Mm-hmm. So I didn't really look beyond that. That was enough for me. The rest of the stuff just seemed like it was extraneous and just kind of thrown in there. But that was his main goal. But overall, I mean, I did enjoy him as the bad guy. I enjoyed the fact that this film was probably more of an ensemble than any other Bond has been in a very long time. Mm. Bond is still the central character, of course, but Q gets a lot of time. M is more of a factor in this film than she's ever been, and Silva as well. And the same goes with Naomi Harris as Eve. She's in the film quite a bit, and Ralph Fiennes as a. As a director who's really kind of putting screws to MI6 at the beginning of the film. So there's a lot of characters here, a lot of talented actors, and a lot of characters that I think are going to play a major role in a franchise from here on out. Yeah. So, I mean, at this point, we're talking about maybe Daniel Craig doing two more movies, and that's probably going to be it for him. I think they've set something up here where Bond is probably as exciting as it's ever been in its history, and for once, I'm really thrilled to see what happens next. Never really cared about what happens with Bond from time to time because it really doesn't matter, and it's never really mattered what happens from movie to movie with Bond. But now I really want to see what happens to him in the future.
Yeah, that's kind of the weird dichotomy of what they've got going on with the way this movie ends, is that you're set up for the previous, with excluding Quantum Solace, with Casino Royale, and especially with this movie, you've set up something that is not an episodic structure of storytelling. It's going to have a concurrent theme going through the whole time, and Bond has always exists on an episodic table. You know, it's always, you know, nobody really thinks about all the stuff that happened before. It's just, you know, it's just like watching an episode of Walking Dead tonight. You know, it's going to be part of this. Well, that's bad. That's a bad analogy because that has a story, but you know what I mean. And like the way they set it up is almost like you're ready for old Bond back, but do we really want old Bond back? And that's kind of the theory I was bringing up earlier about Quantum Solace. Is I think the reason Quantum Solace didn't work at all is that it was a traditional Bond film, and you know there hasn't been a Bond film with deep story and good acting and good dialogue all the way through without all the jokes left and right. And the silly jokes, even Dalton and Pierce Brosnan had silly jokes. That was absent from Casino Royale and Skyfall. Now, Quantum of Solace was a conventional Bond movie, and I think that's why it failed, because once we were given that better product, we didn't want to go back.
Right. So overall, what is your score of Skyfall?
4.5 out of 5 for me. It really, as a lifelong super Bond fan, this was one of my best, my most fun Bond watching experiences.
Same here for me. I gave it a 4.5 out of 5. My favorite Bond yet. I think they did just about everything right here that you could possibly ask for. The only thing I would complain about is that we didn't get enough of Berenice Marlowe as the Bond girl. But otherwise,
that's hilarious. Because I was literally just looking at her name on IMDb to see how to pronounce it to bring that up. Because we didn't even talk about it.
She wasn't much of a factor, to be honest.
No, she's not. But, I mean, she, as far as a Bond, and this isn't misogynistic, but as far as Bond girls go, you judge them on beauty and not contribution to the script.
Right.
And she had a lot of competition with Naomi Harris in there.
Naomi Harris is awesome.
Extremely beautiful in her own right, and actually had a lot to do with the script. But Berenice, however you say it, she is probably the sexiest Bond girl I remember seeing ever. Just like in her eyes, like
no, she's definitely sexy.
Olivia Munn times 10 hotter. So, yeah.
All right. Oh, we're at 7:40 already. All right. Let's talk about Lincoln. Okay. Steven Spielberg's Lincoln. This film is only out in limited release right now. It goes nationwide next week, but we're going to review it now because we can. We're talk about Lincoln. And it's based on the book Team of Rivals by a historian, Doris Kearns Goodwin, and it follows the last 4 months of Lincoln's life, where he's already passed the Emancipation Proclamation. The Civil War is still raging, and he's trying to get slavery abolished full and clear with the passing of the 13th Amendment to the Constitution. And, of course, this causes all sorts of turmoil in the Senate and the Congress, but also within his own cabinet. Daniel Day-Lewis plays Lincoln, and I think people are going to be surprised by how he sounds as Lincoln. I know people probably heard it in clips and TV ads and stuff like that, but I feel like people have never really known how soft-spoken Lincoln really was.
Mm-hmm.
You read the history books, and they'll tell you that. At least some of them will. The more thorough ones will. The other ones will leave it open for debate. But he's really soft-spoken here and quietly charismatic. And I think Daniel Day-Lewis is probably going to get nominated for Best Actor. It's probably a given. And I wouldn't be surprised if he wins. I think he's fantastic here as Lincoln. In fact, the entire cast is great. In my review, I wrote that this one is really sort of mixed emotions for me. Outside of the last couple Democratic presidents, Lincoln is my favorite president of all time. And part of the reason is not because of the sort of elementary school version of Lincoln that we get. Oh, he freed the slaves. Well, the Emancipation Proclamation didn't really free anybody. What I liked about him is that he was a politician like any other.
Mm-hmm.
And he was willing to get down and dirty and do some nasty things in order to get things he wanted to do done. I like that about politicians. Call me crazy. I like that. You know, and I like the fact that he was willing to do that for a good cause. And the good cause wasn't freeing the slaves. Now, I also recognize that he had his own political reasons for wanting to free the slaves. It wasn't as altruistic as a lot of his cool books would have you believe.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things I like about this film is that it doesn't paint Lincoln as just this great altruistic figure. He's a guy who has political ambitions and motivations and is willing to do whatever's necessary. I like that aspect of it. The performances are great, from Tommy Lee Jones in particular. Lee Pace, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and Sally Field are fantastic. But as technically beautiful as the film is and as great as the performances were, I couldn't help but think that the movie was way too goddamn slow. And I got bored after a certain point. This is why I called it mixed emotions, because I acknowledge that there's practically everything right about this film, and yet I was still bored. Now, So that's an issue. That's an issue for me, and I think a lot of it has to do with the dialogue by Tony Kushner, who also did Angels in America and some other things. His dialogue tends to be extremely ponderous. It always has been, and I think it is here as well. Sometimes it grinds the momentum of the film down to a halt, and that's probably my biggest issue with it. So, I mean, overall, I give Lincoln a 3 out of 5. It's a solid film. People will go and they'll enjoy it. I just don't think it's a great film. I think people will get a little tired of it. It is sort of like a history lesson, and not much more in the way of entertainment.
So this is more like, because what I was imagining was it was a movie that starts, you know, it obviously doesn't linger on his early years, but, you know, is like any other biopic where it spends a lot of time establishing everything. So this just starts pretty much after the Civil War is over.
It starts when the Civil War is still going on. This is, like I said, the last 4 months of his life. The Civil War is still going on at that point.
Yeah, that poor guy didn't have a day in office if the Civil War wasn't going on, did he?
pretty much, no. So, no, it doesn't go. It's not a biopic at all, really. It's just this aspect of his reign, of his administration, and kind of just dealing with the political ramifications of his decisions. That's really all it is. So it's not much. It doesn't give much of a look at the man himself. It's about everything else that's going on around him.
Well, you make it sound like they treaded a fine line here. I mean, now while there is a lot to be said for being historically accurate and delving into the parts of Lincoln or looking at things in the true light, not in the glorified light that a lot of people put our American heroes in. I mean, Lincoln, as far as American heroes goes, I think he's at the very top of the list for most people.
Right.
Do you feel like they follow the true story of him, show all this stuff that maybe people didn't know without really tainting the image of the man?
Oh, absolutely. I think if you want to get an accurate picture of who Lincoln was, this movie is probably a pretty good example. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's one of the best examples on screen of Lincoln, because I think most other versions I've seen of Lincoln movies kind of give you the bare bones version, the kind we learn in school version.
Right.
You know, this one is a little bit more complete and is willing to show that he wasn't so perfect. You know, I like that. I like the fact they're willing to do that.
Yeah, well, I'm totally okay with them humanizing and giving the true point of it. I think Spielberg probably was one of the best people to tackle this, just because when you have there's some kind of innate human need to bring people down that are at the top, and when you have somebody like Lincoln that so many people look up to, everybody likes to see a hero fall for some reason. A lot of people would kind of blow up things that maybe wouldn't look so good just to make it look worse. But it sounds like this is the actual truth and not the the Enquirer version of Lincoln's life.
Right, I agree with that.
Awesome. Yeah, and Sally. I mean, a lot of people in this movie that I haven't seen on a screen in a long time in such a big capacity, like Sally Field, James Spader.
You just saw her in Spider-Man.
Oh, you're right. You're right.
Yeah,
I did.
Yeah, Sally Field's been busy lately.
Yeah.
Gidget's been getting a lot of work.
The flying nun, if you will. Those nuns still creep me. I don't know where they are, but whichever ones have that habit like she wears with the wings on the side, I think it was Rosemary's Baby or The Omen or something like that. It still creeps me out. But yes, very, very cute. And Gidget, Smokey the Bandit, amazing.
Yeah.
So, awesome. Well, that's two. I think Lincoln is going to do I don't know why I'm associating Lincoln with Thanksgiving, but I think it's going to do a killing over Thanksgiving weekend. More so even than Bond, because I think. Go ahead.
I totally agree with you. No, I think it's going to do really well. And obviously, it's got Oscar aspirations. And once we get to the box office, you'll see that it's already off to a good start. so I think it's going to do really well overall here.
Yeah, let's talk. Let's go ahead. We're all done with movies, I think. So let's go ahead and jump into box office. Skyfall is reviving, blowing some life into the box office, taking number one with $87 million, blowing out every other Bond that's ever debuted.
Yeah. Quantum of Solace 4 years ago opened at $67 million. That was at that point the record for Bond. So this one blows that out of the water. But the interesting thing to me is that Casino Royale ended its run globally with $594 million. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, Skyfall has been out worldwide for, 2 weeks, something like that?
Mm-hmm.
So it's already at $518 million.
Wow.
So it's going to surpass that probably by Tuesday.
Jesus. Well, I don't think you give a lot of respect to the international box office. Like when we're thinking about it, you know, people say, oh, yeah, international, whatever. But U.S. is what matters. Well, England is probably the size of Texas geographically. But we're talking the entirety of Europe and all everywhere. You know, that's – and it was breaking records all across from what I heard.
It's just like anything else. It's not just America anymore. The domestic numbers don't even really matter that much. We have plenty of movies here that don't do shit stateside, but they'll get endless sequels because they make so much money overseas. The Resident Evil movies are a prime example. The Underworld movies are a prime example. These movies do middling business here in America for the most part, but they make so much money overseas, you'll keep getting sequels forever. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just one of those things. So you got to look at the international market even more so than the domestic market at this point.
No doubt. The number two movie we didn't get to talk about, but what were your thoughts on Wreck-It Ralph?
I enjoyed it a lot. I think it was a little bit of a bait and switch because it's really not as much about video games as they wanted us to believe, as they wanted guys like me to believe. You know, those of us who played those games with Q-Bert and Sonic and Mario when we were younger and kind of still do now today. It's not as much about them as they wanted us to believe it was. It was like that maybe in the beginning of the film, but after that, it becomes sort of a traditional Disney adventure film. And that's fine. I was okay with that. I didn't laugh all that much, but I enjoyed the visuals, and I think they created a lot of memorable characters more so than anything else. So, I mean, I enjoyed it. I gave it 3.5 out of 5.
Nice. Yeah, I agree with you about the bait and switch part. I was. It took me a long time to get over that because I was super stoked about seeing, you know, Zangief and Q-Bert and all those guys. But
you kind of wanted to see all of them in an adventure together with Ralph, and it just wasn't really what the movie was.
Right. So, but it still seems to be doing pretty good at the box office.
Yeah, no, it is. It's up to $93 million in 2 weeks now, so it's doing really well. I wouldn't be surprised if we get a sequel to that at some point. Although I did find it interesting that even when Disney movies do well, they don't compare to what DreamWorks or Pixar does when their movies do really well.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like Disney's like Tangled, which did good,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't compare to what DreamWorks or Pixar does. You know, it's I don't know why that is exactly.
It's karma.
It's something. Well, we can talk about Disney's karma later. Actually, I did a lot of talk about that over the weekend, how they basically own the world. But we'll talk about that later. Number three is Flight, another movie we didn't talk about, really. Flight, the Denzel Washington movie, morality tale. $15 million in its second weekend is still doing really well. It's just barely over 2,000 theaters now. $47.8 million is its total. Did you see Flight?
Yes, and I will say anybody that's on the fence about seeing Flight, that was also a fan of My Name Is Earl, Nadine Velasquez is just as good a reason to see this movie as anything else. But I did like it. I thought it was pretty good.
I liked him. I didn't like the movie all that much.
I can't really tell the difference between the two. I mean, Denzel Washington is pretty much not is. I'm not going to be able to say this. I'm trying to say he's mm-hmm. never unlikable. I honestly, going back, I can't see a single movie that he's done that I didn't like in some facet.
Okay. That's cool. Number four is Argo. It's up to $85.7 million now. Number five is Taken 2 at $131.3. That one's obviously doing really well. Number six is Here Comes the Boom, which won't fucking go away. It just keeps hanging around the damn top 10. And the fact that it's still at number six blows my mind after all this time. $2.55 million this week is still pretty good. $39 million is what it has right now. Cloud Atlas is just it flopped. $22.7 million domestically anyway. Number eight is Pitch Perfect, which I think is kind of the unspoken surprise hit of the fall season.
No
Pitch
doubt,
Perfect,
yeah.
It's up to $59 million now on a very limited marketing campaign, which is mostly limited to social networking, Twitter, Facebook, things like that, but not much in the way of actual TV ads. Mm-hmm. And the fact is it had the strongest hold of any film in the top 10 this week, and it has for weeks now. It's almost been out for 2 months.
It's been out for seven weeks, and it's still maintained. You see, it's one of those movies – I mean, obviously, this is characteristic of a sleeper hit, but it's one of those movies that never made gangbusters, but every month, every week makes the same amount. I mean, our bottom five of the top 10 here are all within $100,000 of each other.
Right.
And there's a lot in movies that you wouldn't even think of that have been out for longer, like Looper and, Frankenweenie, maybe, you know, big movies like this that are long since out of the top 10.
Long gone, yeah. Number nine is The Man with the Iron Fists, which we also did not talk about. This one has been sort of a disaster, and I feel kind of bad for the RZA. $2.49 million this week, $12.7 million total after 2 weeks. This one's fading fast, dropped nearly 70% in its second week. Mm. Had a really bad cinema score last week. I think it had a C+, which is about what I gave it. If I had to give it a grade score, I gave it a 3, and a 3 Gutenberg score. It was just one of those. I think we may have talked about this, but I just think he tried to do too much.
Mm-hmm.
Tried to take on too much as a director, writer, and star. I think it was just too much, and he wasn't able to quite get everything to gel.
I think hopefully these Hollywood people he's come with here are the way that I think they are, and that's Tarantino and Eli Roth. Mm-hmm. I hope they're, you know, less about losing the money that they lost and will back him again maybe when he can get it right. Because let me talk to you, America, and the places abroad that are listening right now. It really kind of disgusts me that of the two fighting movies on the top 10, Kevin James is beating out the RZA's Kung Fu epic. Here Comes the Boom is a better martial arts movie, is what you're saying. So think about that, America, when you go to sleep tonight.
Yeah. He's got a lot of movies coming up for him, so I think it's good that he's moving on to other things and he's not discouraged or anything like that. So I like that. And he's got a good visual style. So, I mean, I'm curious to see how that translates into other genres. I just think this was kind of a misguided first effort for him. He should have went with something simpler.
Yeah.
And number 10 is Hotel Transylvania with $140.9 million domestically. It's over $255 million worldwide, which is why they just greenlit a sequel for 2015. So, and Lincoln opened at 11 theaters and made $900,000, which is $81,000 per site, which is pretty freaking amazing.
Put that in perspective. Skyfall got $25,000 per site.
Right. So we'll see how that goes next week when it rolls out wide. So.
Yep. That's it. The only other thing that I want to bring up is you know, mm-hmm. other than Pitch Perfect having its hold, I think we can expect Argo, which is at week 5 right now, to really have one of the best holds of the year, because it seems like usually at this point people have stopped asking me about movies that have come out, and maybe mm-hmm. you know, if a movie has a long hold, they'll ask me one or two. I still have just as many people asking me every week about Argo as I did the week before it came out.
Yeah.
And I think this is going to be another you know, Thanksgiving time. You know, not the family film that Lincoln might be, but you know, it's going to hold on for quite a long time here, and I'm going to be astounded by where it gets in the end.
No, I think so too. I mean, we haven't even truly got to the Oscar push for it yet, so it's still got time to make even more money than it did than has so far.
No doubt.
Let's jump into DVDs.
DVDs for this week. There's a lot of cool special edition packages coming out.
A lot of DVDs this week.
Yeah, but we'll tackle the biggest release of the week. Pixar's Brave is coming out, mm-hmm. Which we got to see with actual Scotsmen in kilts, which was pretty neat.
Every time I go to a movie where a native to the movie shows up, the movie tends to be disappointing. It's like when I saw that movie about the Princess of Hawaii, I can't remember what her name is, Princess Kailua, or whatever her name is, and they hosted a bunch of Native Islanders in some group, some club, or something like that, and the movie stunk ass. So it was disappointing. And then this movie, to me, was disappointing. I was not a big fan of Brave. I know a lot of other people liked it, especially for its mother-daughter thing it had going on there, but to me, it was just kind of, I don't know, it's kind of distant, didn't really connect with me. So.
Yeah, I like Brave well enough. I think I have a bit of a bias towards it because, you know, the Celtic themes are part of my heritage, so I just like seeing that stuff. It was done beautifully. Everything looked great. And it had enough funny parts. Is it the top of Pixar? No chance, but I think it was good enough. One that wasn't good enough. Go ahead.
I was going to say, speaking of Pixar, I mean, the Pixar Short Films Collection Part 2 is coming out this week. I think Pixar has actually gotten better with their short films than they are with their feature films lately.
Did you ever get to see Party Source Rex?
I did watch it. We had the full movie up on our site, I believe.
Yeah.
So that's where I saw it. Party Source Rex is good. But the real gem that's on this collection is La Luna, which I think played in... Did it play in front of Brave? No, I might have played in front of something else. La Luna is fantastic. A little short fairy tale about a boy who goes out with his family to find out the family profession. And it turned out to be something really spectacular. I don't want to give it away. But the Pixar Short Film Collection 2 is probably something I would consider buying.
So. I think their short films are great because they aren't just little revisits to their old characters. They're actual. You can tell they actually put time into the story. It's not just like, hey, look, Woody and Buzz are back on the screen. You know, they actually do. And I like how they flesh out some of the back characters in their movies. But they always seem to do a great job of stuff. The Watch, I don't think we have to really say anything about that.
How do you waste that kind of talent? Seriously. How do you waste that level of talent?
I think you add Ben Stiller and Vince Vaughn, whose expiration dates are far past.
Well, if that's so, then they need to quit now, because we've got at least another 30, 40 years of seeing those two in movies.
Yeah.
So, they're not that old.
I know, that's a horrible thing, is they're not. You know, like, at least, like, guys like Steve Martin or even Robin Williams, they had the decency to disappear for about, you know, 5 to 6 years in between when you start to get tired of them and they come back. It doesn't seem that way because it's been 30 years since they started. But if you think about it, those guys had some pretty big, whether it was rehab for Williams or, you know, whatever, they had some brief not in the spotlight moments. Savages, you know, I thought this movie was really good. Just kind of like got lost in the summer. I think this is going to be a big hit on DVD. I think a lot of people are going to rent it and really like it.
I'll probably rent it because I still haven't seen it.
Oh yeah, you didn't. Yeah, it's
no,
it's not as good as the trailers make you think it would be. But it is a good movie. It's a lot of fun to watch. And just like I said, just got lost. I don't know if it was the wrong weekend to release it or what, but definitely one people should rent and check out. 2 Days in New York, this is the stories crossing, you know, just one of those regular New York movies where there's 37 stories going on, right?
No. 2 Days in New York is... Yeah, 2 Days in New York is Julie Delpy and Chris Rock. It's a sequel to 2 Days in Paris, her film from a few years ago. And it's actually a fun little quirky film, kind of in the Woody Allen mold. I actually was considering buying it just because I like this one so much better than I did 2 Days in Paris. Because 2 Days in Paris had Adam Goldberg in it, who I can't stand, but this one had Chris Rock in it, who I think is actually fantastic here. So and Julie Delpy, who I mean I just adore. So I'm considering buying that one. If you like Woody Allen style comedies, if you like Julie Delpy, and if you like her, then you probably already know about this movie anyway. Then you probably want to check that out. Here's something that I noticed that I thought was really cool.
What?
The Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles complete series collection with Turtle Van.
That is awesome.
Turtle
Van's
case.
it's like literally, and the coolest thing about it is the little touch that they added. It's a complete classic series collection. It's on sale, almost 15% off. You guys can buy it on Tuesday from PunchDrunkCritics.com. Just click on Shop at PunchDrunkCritics in the upper right-hand corner. But it even comes in a little box like the toys used to. I thought that was the coolest touch. Like, it's got the cellophane front. And the Turtle Van was awesome. I still remember the toy shop pizzas out of the top of it.
It's awesome. It's expensive, too.
That was like a couple steps down from the USS flag. Not USS flag. The battleship from G.I. Joe. And what was the other toy thing that was super expensive that only the rich kid in the block had? It was another kind of fortress. But
I used to like the Mask Boulder Hill playset, and I used to always dig the. I had Castle Grayskull, but I didn't always have the. I don't think I had the Snake Pit.
Mask is something is so like in this pop culture 80s. Reliving that we've done over the last couple years, Mask has been silently left out, and that was always
Mask needs to be adapted for the big screen. Yesterday, there are two things I want to see adapted big time, and Thundercats and Mask are the two. They have to be done at some point, and I'm sure they will, because everything will be done at some point. Shit, they'll probably do Street Frogs at some point. Everything will be done at some point. Other movies.
One last thing about Mask, you know, whenever stuff comes in nostalgia, it's never as good as you remember. You go back and you watch an episode of your show, you're like, it sucks. Mask is the one thing that held true when I watched the intro on YouTube. Like, five months ago, I was like, that intro is awesome. I was like, I bet it sucks now. I turn it on. Just as awesome.
Yeah, it's really cool. Other movies coming out on DVD, Vamps. This is the movie from Amy Heckerling and reuniting with Alicia Silverstone from Clueless, along with Kristen Ritter, and they play two vampires. It looks fucking horrible. Queen of Versailles, which is a documentary that I saw a while back. This one kind of came and went, but it became popular after the fact because of the husband in the movie who plays this, who's this rich guy who owns, he's like the biggest timeshare magnate in the country. And he was one of those guys who was demanding his employees not vote for Obama. So the movie kind of became famous after the fact because they're really stinking rich in the movie. They build the biggest house in the world, and then they can't complete it because of economic hardship. So it was kind of funny. So that's all the movies I had on the list.
Nothing else I got there. Big on Instant Watcher right now on Netflix Instant is Lockout, the movie with Guy Pearce. I think it was a lot better than some people gave it credit for. Not a good movie, but you can check it out. The obvious grab on Zero Dark Thirty, SEAL Team 6, The Raid on Osama Bin Laden. The Road with Viggo Mortensen. Actually, no, that's not the one with Viggo Mortensen. Scratch that. Bernie, a movie that we talked to Richard Linklater about.
Mm-hmm.
So you guys can check that interview out on the site. That's on Netflix Instant. Occupy Unmasked, The Flowers of War with Christian Bale. Out of Sight, George Clooney and J-Lo in her prime, and The New Footloose. You can check those out there.
Sweet. All right, let's talk some news. This was a busy-ass week for news, and I'm not even going to cover everything here, but
yeah,
we have to talk Star Wars Episode 7, because every day there was a new story about it. So let's just start from the beginning. We did talk to Nick Maley about this a little bit.
Yeah.
Earlier in the week, and there's been a lot that happened ever since then. So, I mean, besides the stuff where, you know, Harrison Ford and Carrie Fisher say they both were open to coming back, that's cool, but it's not confirmations of shit. Basically, the main thing that happened this week is that Michael Arndt, who wrote Toy Story 3 and also wrote Little Miss Sunshine, was revealed to have done a 40-to-50 page story treatment for the entire trilogy. And he had done it months ago at George Lucas's request, which indicates, obviously, that this has been in the works for a while. And it also put him at the top of the list to write the script for at least the first film. Well, he got confirmed just maybe a day or two ago. So Michael Arndt will be writing the script for Star Wars Episode 7. So that is a good thing. Yes? John? Did John disappear? I think John has disappeared. And yes, John has disappeared. So I'll take over until he gets back. So Michael Arndt is confirmed to be writing Star Wars Episode 7. I think it's a smart move. The guy's obviously proven. He's a fantastic writer. He's an Oscar winner for Toy Story 3. Good idea on their part, because that's really the foundation of all these things. We've all complained about the scripts for the last three Star Wars movies, four if you want to count Return of the Jedi. And I think Arndt is a guy who knows how to do big action and include high emotional stakes. And that's what we really want out of a big science fiction soap opera like Star Wars. So good move there on Disney's part. So that leaves us with the big question in who's going to be directing it. The earliest reports were saying that Matthew Vaughn was the front runner for the job. Matthew Vaughn was a director of Kick-Ass, X-Men First Class. And it seemed to make sense because just a few days ago... just a few days ago, Matthew Vaughn dropped out of directing X-Men Days of Future Past, the sequel to X-Men First Class. So just a day or two after that happens, here his name pops up as the front runner to direct Star Wars Episode 7. So So it kind of, if you want to take, you know, take that as evidence, you can do that. But then other names started to emerge, and the one that I noticed was Colin Trevorrow, who's the guy who directed Safety Not Guaranteed, a film that I love from Sundance. It came
awesome
out over the summer.
Movie.
A great movie. And he seemed, and apparently George Lucas saw Safety Not Guaranteed and contacted Trevorrow about the job, which puts him on the list. And, you know, I mean, the Safety Not Guaranteed combines romance, comedy, science fiction elements, all the things we expect in Star Wars.
Right.
So he seems like, to me, he's the pick I want to see. I like Matthew Vaughn. I think he's a great director. I want to see Colin Trevorrow, a young guy who is just seeming to be finding his voice as a director. I want to see what he does with it.
No doubt, yeah. And you know, it, as you said to me, because I had just watched Safety Not Guaranteed again, as we're getting its Oscar screener season for us, and had you told me that before I watched it again, I almost would have forgot how great that movie was, and it would have said, I don't understand that. But that was one of my concerns about people taking over Star Wars, and one of my biggest problems with the prequel trilogy is that the original Star Wars, one of the coolest, unique things about it was its dirty future look. You know, I think that's the term they use for it. Basically, like, shit looks used, and it looks like a real world. And even if it is only for 30 seconds, Colin Trevorrow has shown that he can make that sci-fi look that looks natural with everything else around it, even in the oddest of circumstances. And I think that little bit right there is probably what George Lucas saw thought he could take it to the next level with Star Wars.
Right. So, I mean, I really want to see what he does. I think that'd be a – I think if Disney's going to do something like this, and I know the probably the prevailing wisdom is that you you go and you seek out an established hand. I really don't want that. I mean, when they talked about Michael Arndt's treatment, they said that it was being sent to three guys, Steven Spielberg, Brad Bird, and J.J. Abrams. I mean, cool names, you know, cool names. I'm not interested in seeing Steven Spielberg do Star Wars. Thankfully, he already turned it down. I'm not really interested in seeing J.J. Abrams do it either. I mean, he's already got Star Trek. I definitely don't want to see him do Star Wars.
Yeah, that's heresy in the minds of sci-fi
and
fans.
Right, and Brad Bird, I do like him. I think Brad Bird would probably, in my personal opinion, he's probably the, out of those three, the one that would be most likely to take it. He did Mission Impossible, you know. He's an inside Disney Pixar guy, so he probably has a leg up, you know. He might be a solid choice, you know, but I really want to see what Colin Trevorrow could do.
Yeah, I mean, I think with a director, it's, you know, people tend to separate them from actors, but I think you have to could do by the same standard, and that's, you know, when you pick Anakin Skywalker, you know, you didn't want somebody that was known because you'd have Leonardo DiCaprio. You wouldn't have Anakin Skywalker. With directors, it's a lot the same. I mean, a lot of these guys can't make a movie no matter how good they are without putting their stamp on it, even subconsciously. I think you need somebody that's obviously capable of great, great things but hasn't made their self known on the world stage yet.
Right. But unfortunately, I think Brad Bird is probably going to be busy because he's working on this movie 1952, or as it's known now, Tesla, with Damon Lindelof from Lost and George Clooney. So they're working on that. So he probably wouldn't be able to do Star Wars if he wanted to. But did you see? This is probably the last thing we say about Star Wars for the week. But did you see the people the things that Quentin Tarantino and Spielberg and Zack Snyder were saying when they rejected? When they were asked about directing the films?
I don't know who asked Quentin Tarantino in the first place, but yeah, what did they say? I didn't hear.
Well, Spielberg's was just weird. He's like, no, it's not my genre. It's my best friend George's genre. Right, first of all, that's bullshit, because Steven Spielberg does science fiction, so that's bullshit that he would say that. But Tarantino's was funny. Zack Snyder's was just sort of, no, I wouldn't do it because it's too much of a hassle, and if you spuck it up, you're screwed. So yeah. Zack Snyder's, I understand. Tarantino's was funny because he threw another director under the bus. Tarantino, when he was asked about it, said, I could so care less. No, sorry. Especially if Disney's going to do it. I'm not interested in the Simon West version of Star Wars. What the fuck is that?
I think what he means is a movie that most people find enjoyable, as opposed to his that only the select few do.
Actually, more people like Quentin Tarantino than they do Simon West. I get what he. No, don't. There's not even a debate there.
Among serious film fans, yeah. But I think if you put up like if you sat two people down to watch, you know, Con Air and then insert, you know, and then Death Proof, I think people are gonna walk away saying they like Con Air a lot more.
You're picking one movie from Simon West and one movie from Tarantino. I mean,
I just think Tarantino's become pretentious.
If you want to compare their filmographies, I mean, it's not even a comparison. And I think even amongst people who just go to a movie to be entertained, they would still choose Reservoir Dogs. They would still choose The Kill Bills. They would still choose Pulp Fiction. They would still choose any of those over probably the vast majority of Simon West's filmography. And I like Simon West. I don't like being put in a position of knocking him down. But in terms of comparing him to Tarantino, I don't see it. I'm just curious why he got mentioned for no good reason here.
Well, one of the most interesting polls I would like to get a true answer, like anonymous people answering in, is stuff like that. Because, you know, when things like Battleship and movies like this, you know, they do so well. And people I talk to, you know, you hear they like this and they like that. And, you know, I think a lot of people that sit down and watch some Tarantino stuff, they might say it just to sound like they're in there. But I think it gets more popular than it actually gets. That being said, I just don't like, you know, Tarantino is not so he buys his own hype nowadays. Every time I hear him talk, I just want to punch him in the stupid big Jay Leno chin because he's so pretentious, I feel. I don't know. Maybe it's just me, but he just, like, he's like the undercover cool kid at school that just is too cool for his own fucking sauce. So he just gets on my nerves with that.
Okay, I disagree, but we'll leave it there. The only other thing I really wanted to mention earlier, maybe about a week or two ago, there was a rumor that Mark Wahlberg was going to be starring in Michael Bay's next Transformers movie.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Michael Bay came out, I think, later that same day. Yeah, it was later that same day because I held off on writing about it because I wanted to wait to see if he mentioned it on his blog. Well, he did. And he shot down those rumors and said that, no, me and Mark are working on a different film together, a mystery project. Okay, so that's cool. So he wasn't going to be in Transformers 4. Then a few days later, Michael Bay comes back on his blog and says, well, you know, the internet got me thinking about it, and maybe Mark would be good for Transformers 4. So it's like the internet swayed his opinion, and then the very next day, we get the confirmation, Mark Wahlberg will be in Transformers 4. He'll be the lead character, whoever that turns out to be, in the next Transformers movie. So,
I just hope this doesn't work together.
Huh?
No, I was just saying, this doesn't establish a set thing to take the internet's suggestions on many things because, you know, as much as we bitch and complain, you know, and it's not even just us, people on Facebook that don't watch enough movies or all this stuff, but, you know, we often don't really know what's going to work, and even the worst of Hollywood can sometimes put out stuff that's better than what we could come up with on our offhand. So hopefully they don't start taking everybody's ideas.
Well, I think it's bullshit to think that he didn't know. He hadn't considered Mark Wahlberg for the role at all.
No.
Anyway, I think it's bullshit because, first of all, they had just finished working together on Pain and Gain, just finished working together. So, I mean, maybe they had to do some. In fact, he even said it, that they, him and the writer, Aaron Kruger, were changing some things to make Mark's character fit in the movie. So, but still, I mean, to think that the internet is really what swayed him into making that move, I think is bullshit.
If that's the
angle he wants to play it, that's fine. The fact is Mark Wahlberg's going to be in the movie. It comes out in June of 2014, and basically it's going to have an all new cast, new Transformers, and it may or may not take us into space, probably Cybertron.
Yeah, I mean, you got one thing we all got to remember about Michael Bay is that he is the ultimate salesman. I won't say snake oil salesman, but, you know, something, you know, that's why he cuts together such great trailers that get people so hyped up. You know, he knows how to sell stuff, and he knows that, hey, I'm going to be casting Mark Wahlberg in this anyway. might as well, you know, make everybody feel like they had a little part in it because they'll get more hyped up for it and, you know, just cause more stories.
Right. No, I actually agree with that. I think he's like most people. He has his fans. He has, in fact, a lot of fans. He's a very loyal group of fans. And I think he likes letting them feel like they had some part in it. So that's very good. We also learned today, and I think I just finished writing about this right before the show, was that the Transformers 4 will pick up 4 years after Dark of the Moon. So this is 4 years after that major battle in Chicago. So that's where that one's going to pick up at. I don't know how much of a factor it'll be in the story, but I personally just think that they're doing it to wipe the slate clean. And some other sites are saying, it's going to be a major part of the story that what happened 4 years ago. I don't think so, really.
What exactly happened? Like I haven't watched Dark.
I mean, besides Chicago getting basically destroyed by
that's the climax. where do we leave where do we leave Optimus and everybody? Was it just chilling or what?
Pretty much just chilling. But I think you're gonna. I think that what they could do is sort of like what they're probably going to do with the Avengers after the battle in New York, which is where you see stricter government control. A darker. You know, a more restrictive government, all that sort of thing, you know. I think they could go that route. But I think the fact that they're going 4 years to the future, I think it's just because Bay wants to kind of just wipe the slate clean, not have people asking, where's Spike Witwicky at? Where's this Autobot at? You know, if you go far enough into the future, then people won't worry about it so much.
Right. A lot of trailers out this week.
A lot of trailers this week. The Grandmasters, finally the trailer for The Grandmasters. That's a Wong Kar-wai's martial arts film based on the story of Yip Man, the guy who trained Bruce Lee. That trailer's up on the site. A couple of horror remakes, Silent Night, the remake of Silent Night, Deadly Night, and Maniac with Elijah Wood. Both of those look pretty good to me.
Now, is that a remake of the 80s Maniac?
Yes.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Movie 43, another Red Band trailer for that. The Last Stand with Arnold Schwarzenegger. Les Miserables, another trailer for that one. The first trailer for Warm Bodies. This is the zombie romance movie from Jonathan Levine, the guy who did The Wackness, All the Boys Love Mandy Lane, and 50-50. I did not like this trailer at all. I thought I would. I was really hyped for it at one point, and now it looks like crap. And World War Z, another zombie movie, and this is based on the Max Brooks novel, starring Brad Pitt. The book is fantastic. I read the book a couple of months ago. And basically, it's a government bureaucrat who's kind of traveling around the world, getting information on the zombie apocalypse that had just ended. The movie does not look like that at all. It looks like Brad Pitt trying to save the world from zombies, which is a movie I'm far less interested in. But, oh well. What can you do?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of depressing because the book, like you said, is very good. You know, it's written by Max Brooks, who is Mel Brooks' son, which I thought was even more interesting. But it really was a different kind of this was the point I thought that either we adapt or die with the zombie genre, and it looks like we chose to die. You can make your undead jokes here if you like, but yeah, it doesn't look like it's gonna be too good for that one.
Yeah. So that's basically it. You want me to go talk about what's next week?
Let's do that.
Next week's show, we have the Twilight Saga Breaking Dawn. It is finally coming to an end. We've got that next week. Anna Karenina, this is the film from Joe Wright, the guy who did Atonement. And what else did Joe Wright do? Oh, Hannah. That's coming out next week. And Silver Linings Playbook from David O. Russell. This is the film of Bradley Cooper and Jennifer Lawrence, Robert De Niro, Chris Tucker. My review is already up on the site. It's an amazing film. That's all I'm going to say. But the review for next week.
I do like what our other Punch Drunk Critic Rocky had to say about it on a Facebook post, and that said that Bradley Cooper and Jennifer Lawrence are just too damn attractive.
They are, and she is. She is incredible looking in this movie.
Really?
Maybe it's because she's really screwed up in the head, but she, for some reason, she's really a lot more attractive in this movie.
I think that's a scientific fact that most of us men do like girls that are a little bit crazier.
that is absolutely true.
Yeah, though we'll not be talking about it on Sunday. I'm excited that of the dawns that we see this week, Red Dawn will be one of them. We'll be talking to you guys about that a couple weeks from now. But way more excited for that than I am Breaking Dawn. I will definitely say that.
I put up a couple clips from Red Dawn last night, and I wrote at the end that my enthusiasm for this movie has faded, and it really has.
Mm-hmm.
I was excited for Red Dawn after that trailer came out, but everything I've seen since, I'm just like, man, I just kind of want it to be, after waiting for it for 2 years, I just kind of want it to be over. Let me see it and get it over with. But
yeah.
hopefully my mind will be changed in a few days.
Well, I guess I was looking at the release date on IMDb, and they had their user reviews. And just so you know, Travis, that we are wrong, because the user Mblast Mary says, as usual, the pompous critics get it wrong. Red Dawn is a must-see movie for anyone my age, which I can only assume is 13. Mess with us. We're witty. We can get back at you.
Oh, we critics, we never get it right, do we?
Yeah. We're
our word doesn't mean anything. Even when we get it right, we've gotten it wrong.
Yes, if it doesn't have Dostoevsky playing in the background, I'm not watching it. Or I don't know. That's the classiest thing I could come up with. That's a bet. I'm pretty sure that he's not even a composer. I think he's a writer. So I'm gonna stop making myself look like an idiot, and I'll let you close the show out.
While you're behind.
We are the Punch Drunk Critics. You can find us every single day on punchdrunkcritics.com, right here on blogtalkradio.com/punchdrunkcritics every Sunday night at 7. Make sure to keep an eye on the site for all our screenings and giveaways, but also for the special shows we've been doing on Blog Talk Radio, including RZA Imogen Poots is going to be on there for a special show. Just make sure to check that out as well. So check out both sites all the time, every day, nowhere else to go. Facebook.com, we are Punch Drunk Critics. Just search for us. We'll be the first ones you find. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, punchdrunkcritics@gmail.com or @yahoo.com. On Twitter, Travis is @punchycritic. I am @punchdrunkjohn. Why? I feel like there's something else. Oh, if you guys want to shop, you can go to click on shop at Punch Drunk Critics, the upper right-hand corner. I lost how many things I said, so I think I covered everything.
I think so too. Let's get out of here, man. Bears are about to play in about 15 minutes.
Indeed. And Walking Dead is on too. See you guys later.
Later.
We came, we saw, we kicked its ass.
That's it, man. Game over, man. Game over.
I'm not great at farewell, so that'll do, pig.
That's the worst goodbye I've ever heard. And you stole it from a movie.